Welcome to today's Association of the United States Army Thought Leader Podcast on fighting ISIS, past, present, and future. This is Colonel Retired Dan Roper, AUSA's Director of National Security Studies. I will be serving as your host. To address this incredibly complex subject, we are fortunate to be joined today by two uniquely experienced practitioners in the war against ISIS, Major General U.S. Army Retired Dana Pittard and Master Sergeant United States Air Force Retired Wes Bryant, who served together in the earliest stages of the U.S.-led coalition fight against ISIS in Iraq in 2014. General Pittard commanded the U.S.-led coalition that enabled Iraqi security forces to halt the advance of ISIS and then commence the counteroffensive operations that would ultimately lead to a military defeat of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Master Sergeant Wes Bryant was the Senior Special Operations Task Force Joint Terminal Attack Controller, also known as a JTAC, in Baghdad. He was at the forefront of the establishment of the BIAP strike cell and was the tactical lead for the team of Special Operations JTACs tasked to carry out the mission. In addition to their decades of distinguished military service and their exceptional contributions to the initial campaign against ISIS, General Pittard and Master Sergeant Bryant have done the nation a lasting service by capturing their hard-earned experiences and insights in their book, Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell, published by Post Hill Press earlier this year. The perspectives, political, strategic, and operational, of the senior U.S. general on the ground, blended with the tactical experience of the senior enlisted Special Operations JTAC executing the mission, provides multidimensional insights for us all. Our guests have documented an important piece of history on the inside story of a unique campaign. The American people deserve to know, and even more importantly, policymakers must better understand the warfighter's perspective since they make the decisions that guide America's military efforts across the world while often without having the benefit of personal military experience. General Pittard, Master Sergeant Bryant, welcome to today's AUSA's Thought Leader Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thanks so much.
To establish context for our listeners, starting with you, General Pittard, could you tell me what led the two of you to write this book together?
Well, really, the start of the book occurred in the spring of 2015. I was in Baghdad. I heard from a high school and college friend from West Point who said, hey, you know, you ought to write a book about this. And I said, really, that's not something I normally would do. And then within about an hour of that call, I received a call from a literary agent that said, I understand you want to write a book. It was amazing. So started putting together notes and started to write a book about really this story of this, you know, small group of Americans who in 2014 had this really daunting challenge. And it was ISIS at that time seemed like this unstoppable juggernaut, offensive juggernaut in June of 2014. So started writing the book really for about a year. And I asked different people I'd work with for their anecdotes. And I reached out to Wes Bryant and asked him for, you know, maybe a couple sentences, maybe a paragraph on just some things he had seen. Well, after a little while, he got back with me and ended up sending me 25 pages. And the pages were so well written that I thought, shoot, how about being my co-author? So really from 2016 on, this became a joint project between myself and Wes, and from two different perspectives. And that's really unique in so many levels, from the commanding general there in Iraq to the senior enlisted JTAC as one, Army guy, Air Force guy, conservative, liberal. I mean, just the two different perspectives. Wes?
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, don't hate me. We won't say who's conservative. But I was still in. I was actually on a CAS training trip in New Jersey when Dana called me after I'd sent him that little anecdote or the 20-some pages. When he reached out, I thought, God, this is a great chance to really highlight our portion, the JTAC portion in this book that he's writing. I thought it was just fantastic. And very quickly he said, hey, do you want to go in together on this? Because we can have the general's perspective and we can have your perspective as the soft JTAC that I can't bring. And of course I was just ecstatic because I just knew right then we could create something really unique. That's not just compelling, but that I'd say even more importantly, like educate the public, as you said, as you read earlier in the intro, educate the public and the American people on things that they are really ignorant to, not on their own accord, but just because they don't get that information. And the rest is history, three plus year project from there.
I can tell you it was worth it. It definitely did bring out a unique perspective that I'm looking forward to hearing some more about that in just a moment. One more piece of context that would be helpful for our listeners is about some of the terminology right up front, even in the title of your book. Because while ISIS, also known as Daesh, no longer holds any territory, it's not defeated. ISIS recently named as its new caliph Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurashi to replace Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who was killed in a U.S. Special Operations Force raid on October 27th. Could you please explain the distinction between ISIS as a state or caliphate and ISIS as a terrorist organization or movement?
Sure. Obviously, ISIS has this geographical territory-owning caliphate was kind of officially established in June of 2014 when its leader al-Baghdadi stood in front of a mosque in Mosul and proclaimed this caliphate. And at its height, ISIS, which stands for Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, is called by a number of names, ISIL, ISIL. Also in Arabic, it's called Daesh. But at its height, they owned about a third of the territory of Iraq and about 25% of Syria. So it really was huge at one point. ISIS as a geographical territory owning caliphate has now been defeated. And that occurred really in late 2017. But as we talk about in our book, Hunting the Caliphate, one might even argue that now that ISIS is no longer owning territory, but is now a terrorist network, it's a very lethal and dangerous terrorist network. In fact, in some ways might even be as dangerous as it was before, except now it's focused on terrorism in the region, as well as the West and even in America, and it's well funded. So that would be the difference between the two. ISIS as a caliphate with territory, and ISIS now is a very dangerous terrorist network.
Great. Backing up a little bit, could you describe the security situation in Iraq in 2014 as you two both entered the picture there?
Sure. It was in January of 2014 when ISIS first kind of came into Western Iraq through Al-Anbar province and ended up taking over Fallujah. That raised some attention, but not really alarms throughout the Middle East and the world. In fact, at that time, U.S. President Obama said that he looked at ISIS almost as a JV, or like junior varsity, and the Iraqi security forces could handle them. It appeared like at least the Iraqi security forces had contained ISIS at that time. Where ISIS really startled the world was a little bit later in the year, on June 9th, 2014, when ISIS, literally with an army, took over northern Iraq and seized Iraq's second largest city of Mosul with over 1 million people. That absolutely raised alarms throughout the world. In fact, the U.S. response to that was to send myself and about 300 special operators and staff to Baghdad. It's really to assess the situation and kind of come up with options. And at that time, the concern was that ISIS was this offensive, unstoppable juggernaut that was now coming at Baghdad through the Tigris River Valley from north to south towards Baghdad and from west to east along the Euphrates Valley. Because Benghazi and Libya had just occurred 2 years before that with the unfortunate death of Ambassador Stevens and three other Americans, there was a lot of concern with the U.S. administration and the U.S. in general about our embassy in Baghdad. So by the time we all got there, within 10 days to 2 weeks of Mosul falling, our initial assessment was that the embassy could hold. But the embassy at that time was partially evacuated already. A third of the embassy personnel had already been evacuated. Now, with the U.S. embassy in Iraq, there in Baghdad, that's a big deal. The Baghdad embassy is the U.S.'s largest embassy in the entire world, believe it or not. So that was a big deal at that time. So when I arrived, the ambassador met me and said, hey, this is what we're looking as far as possible evacuation plans. And the defense attaché there said, yep, we're ready to evacuate. They'd already evacuated the Office of Security Cooperation in Iraq from about 150 people down to 30. And at that time, I kind of put up my hand and said, yeah, let's just see. Let me do an assessment here. So within 48 hours, we assessed that, in fact, Baghdad could hold. And at the time, that was kind of controversial. For the U.S. administration at the time, President Obama wasn't really focused on fighting ISIS. Our recommendation was to hit ISIS immediately and support the Iraqi security forces. But, you know, it was an administration that was elected really to end wars in 2008. So that just wasn't their natural bent. So we continue to assess. We continue to watch ISIS for 6 more weeks. And then in August 2014, ISIS made a strategic error in attacking the Kurds. And at that time, with what was happening on Mount Sinjar and surrounding Yazidis, it was a humanitarian crisis. So it was at that point that President Obama allowed us to begin airstrikes. And that's how the fight with ISIS began.
Could you describe the steps you took at that point, establishing the strike cell and what the strike cell was comprised of?
In fact, there was a number of things going on at that time. One is to really establish the Joint Forces Land Component Command there in Iraq, which we did on the embassy compound. And at the same time, for protection of U.S. forces, began really this initial strike cell in the Baghdad embassy. When we actually did airstrikes in August of 2014, it was from the strike cell that was in the Baghdad embassy. In a minute, allow Wes to describe exactly what's in a strike cell. But initially, we started having some issues with legality because it was concerned that running a strike cell out of the embassy would cause concern on the embassy's overall status. Based on that, in late August and early September of 2014, we moved the strike cell from the Baghdad embassy compound to the Baghdad International Airport, also called BIAP. Wes?
Yes, thank you. And that's where I come in the book, because at the embassy compound, well, not just in the book, but in real life, General Buttar was running a strike cell really out of his operations center first couple of few weeks with the TACP JTACs over there that were under his staff. That wasn't supposed to be a full-fledged, hey, we're starting the strike cell thing. It was temporary. At the same time, there was a very small bare-bones strike cell up in the north in Erbil, run by another special operations task force where we'd sent a couple of our guys, but we're talking a handful of people running strikes up in the north. Those are the guys that helped liberate, so to speak, but liberate in a very late manner the Yazidi genocide and crisis in Sinjar. So when General Buttar eventually established the authorities or worked to get these authorities along with, other senior leaders in the chain of command from the Obama administration to actually go after and defeat ISIS Iraq-wide, because it was very much, there were not floodgates open when the airstrikes first happened up in the north based off the Yazidi crisis in early August. It was kind of little by little. And eventually, a couple weeks into it, the Obama administration said, okay, we'll allow you to go after ISIS wherever you find them now. And Dana can talk a little more on that, on the red line that was drawn and stories related. But once General Buttar wanted to open this full-fledged strike cell, there were issues with keeping it going at the embassy. The guys were literally running strikes, and we had a couple of our special operations JTACs helping in the embassy at that point early on, running strikes from the embassy. So there were questions on legality, especially from the State Department. So General Buttar said, hey, we're moving it over to the Baghdad airport, right next to where the Crisis Response Force, which I was a part of, ended up being called the Special Operations Task Force Iraq, right next to that compound. Well, I was the senior enlisted JTAC for that task force. Then so me, and then another character in the book, Vern, he was a lieutenant commander and an F-18 pilot, JTAC qualified, and my fires officer for the task force. We ended up going in, working with Colonel Kehoe, a field artillery brigade commander, who gave us the kind of the infrastructure and the staff to set up the strike cell. We went in, took our JTAC. I had my Air Force TACP and CCT JTACs, TACPs and combat controllers. Vern had some JTAC qualified SEALs. And then in our task force, we also had a couple of JTAC qualified Green Berets. We took all these guys, a core of about maybe a dozen of us, then Colonel Kehoe's staff, a couple of our intel analysts from the task force as well. And we opened up this strike cell and started going at it basically. And initially in south and southwest Baghdad, and then covering all of central and western Iraq.
Could you both describe the challenge of coordinating fires remotely without your own eyes directly on, and the overall joint integration of intelligence, fires, and maneuver?
Well, yeah, obviously that was a huge potential issue. As part of the issue was that we weren't allowed to have boots on the ground, initially at least, with the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga. There was just a lot of concern about that. So that was a restriction placed on us by the administration. And so if there's a theme throughout this, it's that as an overall task force, we had to be adaptive, innovative, and really flexible. So one innovative workaround to that was this concept of the strike cell. But in order for that to work, we had to make sure we had special forces teams in the major headquarters of different elements. So you had the Baghdad command, you had the Salah Adid army command, you had the Al-Anbar army command. So we would have special forces teams with them so they could sit down, as close to the tactical level with their Iraqi and Kurdish counterparts for translation and understanding of their needs for support. Then also at my level, a little more operational level, and working with the Iraqi Joint Forces Commander, General Al-Kanani, we would actually develop the initial planning and carefully going over schemes of maneuver and how we could best support that with integrating fires in our intel systems over and over. In fact, because of that, I asked for a SAMS qualified planner. We did finally get, who was extremely helpful. We ended up having two of them, very, very helpful. Our J3 was a Marine colonel. Colonel Ed Abisalon was also, part of the genius behind this. As far as working very closely with the Iraqi military leadership on schemes of maneuver and how we were going to go about this. Integrating that was all done very carefully. We would go back and forth in new rehearsals with the Iraqis. And then I had to have the plans approved, both at the RCENT and or CJTF OIR level with Lieutenant General Terry, and the CENTCOM level by General Lloyd Austin. With a lot of questions, we would tweak it, and then we would go ahead and proceed. And what was good is that we had the support from manned and unmanned aerial intel systems, all levels of intelligence, all the national intelligence that was in support of what we were doing.
Wes, how did it look from your perspective?
Strike cells that we began, they were really an extension of JTAC on the ground. And we had done that in the past. We had been doing what we normally call remotely controlled strikes on high value targets, sometimes for, what we call pre-assault fires for big offensive operations, specifically in those last few years up to ISIS in Afghanistan, once that became primarily a special operations mission. And then we had pulled out of Iraq in 2011. But it was on a small scale. Most of the airstrikes we were controlling were with a JTAC forward on the ground and some usually eyes on the target, or at least having another friendly force somewhere nearby with eyes right on the target. So we took that concept and we amplified it, times 100, so to speak, with these strike cells. And the one that we created on BIAP was actually, it was quick, it was ad hoc, it was out of a mobile trailer. It was nothing fancy at all, but we had the comms. We had enough comms to reach out over 100 miles line of sight at the time. Of course, then we have our SATCOM capability and our other digital capabilities. We had our tie-ins, our feeds up in front that tied in with any drones we had, as well as line of sight feed from our fighter and bomber aircraft that came and showed up. And so we would have up front in the primary line, we had three lines of chairs there and maybe about 20 people in this initial buy-up strike cell. We have the JTACs up front, a senior guy like me or the fires officer, Vern, and then one or two other JTACs in the seat to help. We had our ITC or our ISR tactical controllers, our assistants with drone controlling, who are also intel analysts, so they'd be our targeters. Colonel Keogh had targeters in the staff. We had collateral damage estimation analysts with us. General Batard had his staff lawyers. And then we had a liaison from the task force, either a Green Beret or a SEAL would sit with us as well. And he would help us relay back and forth to the teams that General Batard was discussing at the operations centers, who were tied in directly with our ground Iraqi forces. So that was really helpful. So we were tied in with the air, comm-wise, picture-wise. We were tied in with the ground through our soft liaisons down to the team level. And we would get information from our forward maneuver forces, our Iraqi partner forces, sometimes real time. And then sometimes it would be quite a delay. It just depended how it goes. I mean, there are times when General Batard was actually on the phone with forward Iraqi commanders on cell phone with them. We're hearing gunshots in the distance and watching that same fight on the feed in front of us and then supporting with airstrikes.
If I could also add one more thing in that, Wes is being very humble about the difference between the two strike cells. The strike cell in the Baghdad embassy was really more conventional JTACs for the most part, and they were good. But what I was really looking for, and I asked Colonel Kehoe, the brigade commander of 17 FA brigade, you know, the HIMARS brigade, was for him and his staff to really develop that strike cell and BIAP, because I wanted us to take more risks. And it was perfect having our special ops folks, Air Force Special Ops, Navy SEALs, Army Green Berets, who had done this before at a smaller scale in Afghanistan and other places. But at that time, there hadn't been a strike cell at the scale that we were looking at, covering all of central and western Iraq, for example. And we had another strike cell up in Erbil that took care of northern Iraq and portions of Syria. So it just hadn't been tried on that scale. And being on that scale, we also knew we had to take more risks, because at that time, ISIS had the momentum. ISIS had the strategic momentum, they had operational momentum, and they even had tactical momentum, because they appeared to be more motivated, more disciplined than the Iraqi security forces they were fighting. It was not an accident that the ISIS forces that took Mosul basically destroyed five Iraqi divisions, four army Iraqi divisions and one federal police division of the Iraqi security forces.
Definitely seemed like you were in unprecedented ground there. One particular passage in the book on Wes's contributions was describing when you put all the JTACs together, entities that are usually out by themselves or out with a maneuver unit kind of coordinating fires all by themselves, the chemistry is different when you put a bunch of highly qualified experts in a small trailer with a big mission. It sounded like it was a very interesting dynamic for you.
Definitely caged wolves is what I think Wes referred to them as. And that, in fact, initially they weren't believers that this concept could even work like this. I was like, nothing can take the place of a person on the ground. But once you saw the aerial feeds from our Predator drones, you really had a bigger view of a particular fight. Because usually the JTAC only sees one end of it as opposed to the entire battlefield. But I'll send that over to Wes and get his thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I relate, as Dana said, I relate a pretty good story between me and another experienced peer, combat control JTAC that I worked with in the strike cell most nights, a story of that kind of tension coming to a head. And so, yeah, as Dana said, we definitely didn't want to do the strike cell. If we had our choice, we would have been out on forward combat ops. I mean, just it's the nature of really not just us as special operators as JTACs, but most warfighters. They would rather be out there in the fight, engaging man to man with that enemy force. It's not just about ego or honor. It's because it's actually a little easier. It was much harder, with exception of the bullets flying out. It was much harder taking those same concepts and having to hunt down our enemy, safeguard our forward partner forces who are maneuvering all over the place, sometimes just chaotically, and wrangle those partner forces in offensive operations, as well as safely prosecute targets onto the enemy that they're fighting, and do all that without killing civilians, without causing undue collateral damage, without causing fratricide. So difficult when you're talking about doing it remotely. And then you add in that aspect of not just a group of special ops JTACs, but it was now Green Berets, SEALs, and Air Force JTAC. We might work together on teams sometimes, but all those guys together functioning as JTACs in one cell, it was so difficult early on, but we pulled it off. We got together. We had a mission, and you basically come together to accomplish that mission no matter what, even with all the hiccups.
And the coordination of fires was complex just with the Iraqi security forces as well as with the Kurds. It was really the first time, believe it or not, that U.S. Air Force, coalition Air Force, and Iraqi fighter bombers had to do coordination, believe it or not. That had not occurred before in the past. And then that was complex enough, but it became wickedly complex. We gave an example in the book of the lifting of the siege of Amerli, when you had three different forces, one coming from the north towards Amerli, and that's with the Kurdish Peshmerga, with our special forces in support, one coming from the south, which was the Iraqi security forces, and then one coming from the east, which was a combination of Kurdish Peshmerga, Iraqi Shia militias, supported by Iranian advisors, Iranian artillery, and even some Iranian aircraft. So all that had to be deconflicted. And At the same time, we couldn't necessarily talk directly to the Iranians. We had to talk with them indirectly through Iraqi emissaries and trying to, again, coordinate that and make sure that no friendly forces were hit.
That's an excellent lead into the next question I was going to ask you both. The coalition was seeking to fight the terror group by, with, and through local and regional forces who would do the frontline fighting. We've already discussed that a little bit. What did you learn about leveraging allies and partner capabilities that's something the U.S. military needs to take to heart and use moving forward?
Yes, I think there are some key lessons learned there. I mean, if you compare the campaign against ISIS from 2014 through the end of 2017, even maybe you can say early 2018, and compare that to our surge in Iraq in 2007, 2008. At the height of the surge, we had 165,000 troops on the ground, along with Iraqi security forces fighting an insurgency. At the height of our fighting against ISIS, I believe, and we'll have to check the figures, but there was no more than 15,000 U.S. troops. In fact, during the time we were there, the number was less than 2,000. So it was the idea of having this smaller footprint now for the U.S., but really enabling our indigenous allies on the ground, such as the Iraqi security forces, the Kurdish Peshmerga, the Syrian Kurds, YPG, or now, SDF, even the Shia militias as a part of this anti-ISIS coalition. So I think that is a good lesson learned for at least the immediate future, is with the support of a strike cell, few advisors on the ground, you can minimize the U.S. footprint and then allow, a country to take back their own country themselves, which becomes much more appreciative by that country because they're doing it themselves with just some enabling help from us. And so that is certainly a key lesson learned. And there's a chapter in the book where Senator McCain, who I've got great respect for, visited and insisted that we needed 50,000 troops on the ground. And we explained that, this isn't a surge. We are being successful. We are winning with less U.S. troops on the ground. And that certainly can be a lesson learned for the future.
Yeah, I agree. I taking it to this recent Syria news, I saw some commentary in the news on, well, we only have a handful of U.S. forces there. What were they doing? Well, our book and that story is case in point of really with a handful of U.S. forces at this point and our modern capabilities, we are more dangerous than most nations' armies.
You both anticipated what I'd like to pose as the last question, and it's based on the fact that the 2018 National Defense Strategy, which really describes the trajectory of the U.S. Defense Department and security, it states in there that despite the defeat of the ISIS caliphate, threats to stability remain as terrorist groups with long reach continue to murder the innocent and threaten peace more broadly. Could you just comment one more time on the relevance of what your experience was as documented in your book that really needs to be embedded into the U.S. military and security psyche moving forward?
Well, one is certainly that we're capable of doing things against an enemy anywhere in the world at any time. And you can do that, as I mentioned before, with a smaller footprint. A smaller footprint that's enabled by our technology and the might of the U.S. military to back it up. Also enabling our partner nations forces, indigenous forces on the ground with advisors, with training to an extent, but even more so with advisors. What we always felt, at least in 2014, our Iraqi security force counterparts would say, hey, we need more training, we need more equipment. And my answer back to them is, okay, we'll work on the equipment, but training, you're as well trained, if not better trained, than the ISIS fighters fighting you. Get on out there, and with the support of our airstrikes, we can defeat ISIS. And we did. Engagement, battle after battle, that we were able to do that, again, with a small footprint enabled by U.S. air power, U.S. forces, U.S. technology overall. So I do think that is something, as we look forward to our national defense strategy, having smaller footprints in different places around the world and being prepared. But the big deal is still working with our allies on the ground who have the knowledge of the terrain, of the people. We will never be able to fully replicate that. And that's why a smaller footprint on the ground, I do think, is the way to move forward, at least in a situation like this.
Your thoughts on that, Wes?
Yeah, absolutely agree. In a situation like this, and you know, Dana said before, it won't always apply. We can't say, hey, we've got this new method of warfare. We're going to just do this from now on, because it won't work in every situation, especially when we talk about near peer adversaries. But now, from 2014 up to today, what we see in our general operating TTP, really in all three major areas where we're at, well, we'll say primarily Iraq and Afghanistan now, we have developed these TTPs and really this new doctrinal guidance. And we now do a mix of forward operations and strike cell operations to the level that we never did before 2014. So it's really augmented our warfighting capability. We haven't gone all out on, hey, we're just doing strike cell stuff now. You know, in Afghanistan, we've got a small footprint, but all our teams are going forward and getting in it. And you see the evidence of that with the KIA that are occurring at least monthly still with our soft forces. And those operations are being augmented by strike cell operations, which I highlight in one of the portions on Afghanistan in the book. And for me, a big lesson learned from my entire career, but especially this last part when we went against ISIS in 2014, is the really unprecedented ability for the military, from senior levels all the way down to the private on the ground, or the airman on the ground in my case, right, is that adaptability and flexibility. I haven't seen any other nation's military that has it to the level that we do. Because sometimes, and both you guys fully know from having been there, you know, we're thrown something by an administration or by even senior military command, CENTCOM, for example, to say, hey, go do this. And we usually don't have all the tools or proper guidance necessary to do it, and we just figure it out. And the American military is just hands down the best at that.
I will add one more thing, and that has to do with communicating to our political leadership and the American public. That was one reason why I wrote the book, because initially there were no journalists allowed to be embedded in the forces. So I thought that ISIS on the information level was doing better than we were. They had as many as 90,000 tweets a day. And from our end of it, we were tight-lipped on what we were doing. So at least for the first probably year, the American public thought we were losing against ISIS, when in fact, we had stopped the ISIS momentum in the first couple of months of the conflict. The rest of the conflict was then going down and digging them out and rooting them out of different places. But their offensive juggernaut had been defeated early. But we weren't able to convey that to the American people. And that's something we got to look to do better in the future.
I absolutely agree. And you brought up several vignettes in the book that we don't really have time to develop. I'd really encourage people that want to understand that better. You provided some excellent examples of the challenge of communicating, you know, both from military to more senior military leaders, as well as to the political leaders that make the decisions. So again, that's worthy of a whole separate podcast all by itself. General Dana Pittard, Master Sergeant Wes Bryant, thank you for being with us today and for sharing your insights and experiences on this evolving threat to the nation's defense. I hope that our listeners and those who help policymakers make difficult decisions regarding the use of America's military will take the time to read Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. We look forward to both your continued contributions in the future.
Well, Dan, thank you. And thank you to the entire USA organization for this opportunity to educate and inform.
Yes, very appreciative. This was a great conversation as well. Thank you.
Thank you. To all of our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Keep it here for all Army Matters and for next week's episode. Remember, AUSA is the U.S. Army's professional association, providing a voice for the Army and support for its soldiers and their families. For more information about AUSA or to become a member, please visit AUSA.org. Thank you.